coming up on this week's book show. In Susan Conway's new novel, Landslide, a mother is caring for her two sons while everything else, her marriage and the fishing industry her New England community relies on, threatens to crumble around her. Susan Conway on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In Susan Conway's new novel, Landslide, a mother is caring for her two sons while everything else, her marriage and the fishing industry her New England community relies on, threatens to crumble around her. After a fishing accident leaves her husband hospitalized across the border in Canada, Jill is left to look after her teenage boys alone. Susan Conway is the author of three previous novels, including Elsie Comes Home and a memoir, The Foremost Good Fortune. In speaking with Susan Conway, we talk about her boys, or she refers to them as the wolves in the novel. In the novel, money is tight. Her son Sam is getting into more trouble by the day. Her eldest Charlie has a new girlfriend, and Jill begins to suspect that her marriage isn't as stable as she once believed, all while trying to figure out the wolves. You write very early on, I tell myself it's a beautiful face responding to your son. It's important to tell myself that many things about teenage boys are beautiful so I don't panic. How much was that the story that you wanted to tell about teenagers?
That was an early line in the book. And once I landed on that line, I knew I had some room to move around and some humor. I was glad that Jill was going to operate with humor. I have two of the boy species, as I like to say. they are graduating from teenagehood almost, but not quite. One is still in teenagehood. And I like to say that I have learned to speak boy. I am a huge fan of the teenage boy, because I learned the language, and this book is meant to celebrate them and poke some fun and really honor their inner lives. I mean, I was very interested in teenage boy. I think that was the primary driver, that and then that love letter to Maine. Those were really the drivers here. And really trying to show the reader how the veneer of a teenage boy is so thin before we get to the vulnerable inside. And that they're usually prodded well with humor and self-deprecation on the part of the parent.
Now, Jill often has this wonder if she's doing it right and concern that she's not, and very aware if she, quote, has them at that moment or not, and will say, oh, I just lost them. That seems to be reoccurring throughout the book.
That's sort of the day-to-day state of parenthood of this species. I mean, it's all about connection, and it is a case of getting it, losing it, getting it. You know, this isn't an autobiographical novel per se, but I'm you know, huge believer in bringing our emotional truths to the page and exploring them in fiction. So I'm acutely aware of the tenuous sort of electrical connection between the parent and the child. And I think it's so marked now with social media and devices, you know, how to capture. Jill's constantly trying to like tap dance to catch her boy Sam and Charlie's attention. And it's humorous, but it's also kind of the water they're swimming in. And in fact, Jill, now that I think of it, Jill tries to use their lack of, if they won't pay attention to her, or they won't abide, you know, it's always a threat of will she take one of their devices, until that becomes an empty threat.
At one point, she just realizes that it's not, like, what does that do? It's not even worth all of the trouble that it causes.
Exactly. That's sort of a turning point for her, actually.
Yes, of understanding what that means. So let's talk about the boys. There is Sam, who is the younger of the two, and is coming out of a real trauma in the sense that he has lost one of his best friends in an accident and is dealing with that. And Jill, as a parent, is very aware of that. And also he starts getting into trouble, which she, Jill, is trying to figure out as well.
Yeah, so he's getting into fairly standard teenage boy trouble.
Right.
And the difference for him is that he's got this trauma. He's suffered this great loss. And it happens early on in the book. And so what I did there is I wanted to compound his pressure, and show how, you know, it's a lot on the teenage boy plate to begin with, this navigating of identity and self and opening up your heart, and also, you know, trying on these sort of tropes of American masculinity. And then he's got this trauma that he can't really access anymore. It's a great pain that he's carrying. And that gave me a lot of opportunity to explore, well, how do you try to reach a teenage boy who's really suffering? And it got me into a position to really look at this idea of silencing of the teenage boy that we're hearing a lot about. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there's the older boy, Charlie, who is starting to date. You are, as Jill, as a parent, is trying to figure out is this kid having sex? Is he not having sex? All of those concerns, as you said, regular teen boy concerns and stories. One of the things I find interesting about Charlie that Jill keeps on reminding him and concerned about is that he is often parenting Sam in a way separate from Jill.
Yeah. I'm glad you got kind of a kick out of that. I mean, he's doing this thing where he's pretending he's almost an adult. And she does. She reminds him several times. Like, remember, you need to stop doing that. We decided you were going to stop doing that. And it's kind of this moral high ground, which I have seen brothers play out with each other again and again. And it's not always birth order in my observations, because I've had so many, as I call them, wolves in and out of my house over the last 20 years. But there's definitely a superiority thing going on there for Charlie. And, you know, I hadn't thought about this so much, but Sam is taller than Charlie. He's the younger one, but he's taller. Mm. And it kind of gives him a little bit of a leg up. And I think Charlie needs to keep reminding Sam, you know, I'm the older one.
It's the back and forth between the two, like a typical brother relationship. They're there when they need each other, but they also annoy the hell out of each other.
Exactly.
Susan Conley is our guest. The new novel is Landslide. It is published by Knopf. So let's talk about the relationship between Kit and Jill. And when the book opens, Kit, who is a fisherman and has had a very serious accident and is in a hospital in Canada, you open it up with setting it up that way, that Kit is out of the house, has been out of the house for a while now in a hospital recuperating, and Jill is left trying to figure all of that out.
Yeah, I wanted to create immediate distance in the marriage to see what would happen when we left the wolves and their mom on the island, this tiny little island in Maine, alone. And, You know, Jill is tough. She grew up working class inland in Maine, and she has a really good sense of humor. But this is testing her because Kit has been gone already 3 months on a seasonal swordfish boat, and now he's terribly injured. He got helicoptered to this hospital in Halifax, and she is torn because, as much as the two teenage boys may have sort of, you know, what might look from the outside like garden variety troubles, I think we all know that whatever trouble is happening in our own family orbit is capital T trouble. You know, it grows or it resonates, and she knows that she's losing, particularly Sam, like that she actually has to physically be there, you know, eye on him to keep him from smoking pot or not going to school or, you know, sort of slipping away. So there's this constant pressure, and she's physically back and forth between Nova Scotia and Maine, and then she's psychologically really torn. And I think that distance, the physical distance, is also creates a sort of symbolic distance in the marriage that I really wanted to look at. What does marriage look like when the teens are older? They've been married now 20 odd years. You know, how do we describe this marriage? I was very interested in that.
And it seems as though the kids are often trying to describe it for her and for him, because they're saying, well, Dad would want this, and also wanting a relationship because they miss their father who has been away for so long.
Yeah, that's so true. I love that you're pointing that out, that they really like their dad. He's funny. He's also super physical. He's a hugger and a picker-upper. You know, he's what do we call him in the book? I call him the loner with a thousand friends. He's
right.
he's beloved in the village and on the coast. He's known as one of the fishermen who succeeds. You know, it's a small community of commercial fishermen in Maine. And everybody knows everybody, and he's known to not come home empty-handed. And now he's gone, and in a way, his legend kind of grows, I think, for the boys. I've watched this in my own world here, that there's this kind of beautiful moment, if you can let it be beautiful, where I see teenage boys start to gravitate more to the father, you know, if they're so lucky as to have a father around. Who they admire, and they kind of start that breaking with the mom. And I think in a way this novel is kind of a novel about the leave-taking of the mom.
Mm-hmm.
And they start to really find camaraderie actually with the father. And Sam, the younger boy, all he wants is to be a fisherman, just like his dad. I mean, he doesn't even want to graduate from high school. And I grew up with so many boys like that here in Maine, and, you know, still it's such an incredibly respected profession. So I see that a lot here.
It's also fascinating because while all of this is happening, Jill has a career. She is a filmmaker. And it is that balance that you write about as well. And you read at one point in the novel, I was often alone with the boys when they were babies. It took several years to figure out the balance between taking care of them and making the films. What I really mean is that I never figured out the balance. The boys always caught me by surprise with what they required, the amounts of love and attention. And I still think of those years sometimes as the lost years, or the years I was invisible. That's very powerful as a reflection.
Yeah, I really wanted to put words to that phenomenon. You know, now I'm ancient. I'm in my early 50s, and I look back at that time and I see, you know, the legions of mothers with the young children, and I know from my personal experience and from everything I've heard and talked about, which is a lot of talking, is the invisible years. And the sort of balancing act, and the identity crisis. And it's always a question of how a woman will come through it, you know, and it's a question of class and what she can afford. you know, on the island in Maine, they don't have, there's not even the chance for childcare. And I think that Jill has deeply, deeply enjoyed the time out on the island and also has had that identity crisis. I mean, at one point she says, this is the most beautiful place in the world. But at another moment, as it gets colder and colder out there, she says, you've got to leave a main island before it becomes a prison.
Jill, also, in thinking about all this and that invisible part that we were talking about, just I think a chapter or two later, Jill says, I've started keeping a running list in my mind of things I need to do for the wolves. On bad days, I call this the list of resentments. I try not to think about the list, but my brain would have worked differently without the boys. I think it would have stayed more open and that I would be making more films and not a list of resentments. That is funny. Yeah, the list of what I have to do. And oh, by the way, I resent every one of them.
You know, I think it's a great luxury, you know, to have wolves that you can then make a list of resentments over. So I do think Jill, there's a humor to her voice. She's learned in a way to be sarcastic because that is the bread and butter of these boys. I think they've taught her sarcasm in a way, and they've taught her how to text. but I think she, you know, in the sort of more sort of metaphysical or existential sense, they have created a list of resentments for her. And she'll miss that list. That's the irony, right? That's always the rub. Mm-hmm. She'll miss that list terribly in the years to come.
And she's trying to figure out, they're all really trying to figure out the future, because Kit's injuries are significant enough to wonder, well, what's going to happen when he comes home? And what's going to happen with the livelihood? Because we don't know how, we assume he's going to live, but at what point, how damaged is he going to be as a result of this accident?
Right. I think that's such a great question. And you know what it made me think of is the title, you know,
right.
Oh, landslide. Landslide of trouble, landslide of unknowns. So, and a subtitle could have been, what's going to happen? because we don't know. We hope he's going to fish again. And we hope that the main fishing industry will survive. And it will only do that with really innovative, sustainable fishing practices, which are now really in place. So the stocks are coming back. But is it too late? Because we've lost so much of our infrastructure here.
And this is something that Kit's father is also dealing with and is... I think semi-skeptical of, right? And is trying to pave the way for his son as well as for his daughter-in-law and his grandsons.
Yeah, so Kit's father is, I think he's like sixth generation. His name is Jimmy, and he's that guy. He's, I think at one point I call him like, if you were in a village in Ireland, I've spent some time in Ireland and I learned that there was a king in each village who was the best fisherman, and he had the biggest house. And it's like Jimmy's the king of Sewell Village. He's a big-hearted, cantankerous man. He's also a lobsterman, which is different than his son. His son chose fishing, and the difference is huge. And therein lies everything. You know, lobstering is thriving in Maine. I mean, it's still a hard way to make a living, but it's fruitful, by and large. There's lots of lobsters still. I say that maybe with parentheses around it as the water's warm. But fishing, no. You know, stocks were decimated. So Jimmy's very much one foot in the past. He's also really protective of the idea of the legacy that Kit will fish and he will fish on his boat. That family will not lose that boat. Oh, and by the way, boys don't cry, and you have to be tough.
And this happens as everyone is having trouble, because even The boys, yeah, they are crying because there's real sadness and harrowing things that are happening around them.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, you know, it kind of takes us back to that idea of connectivity that we were talking about earlier, that if Jill's done anything right, she's stuck around, she's stayed in there so that they can cry to her. I mean, I think each boy has these, you know, moments of, I thought, you know, really important vulnerability, and they each cry and they each say, I'm suffering in different ways, or I'm scared. And these are just small moments between a boy and a mother, but frankly, I don't see them depicted that often in contemporary literature, and I was starving for them, which is one of the reasons why I wrote the book.
My mother, who has passed, but was the mother of five boys, me being the youngest, and she always said that people said, I don't know how you raise five boys, and she said, I don't know how I would have ever raised a girl after having raised five boys. And I found that to be fascinating, because I think she learned to speak wolf or teenage boy or however you would like to phrase it pretty early on. But it's fascinating. And also the that now, let's say 12 years after her passing, the reverie that all of us have for our mother is just shocking, because it's so solid. There's a sainthood there that I don't think it's made up. It's probably well deserved, but it is that we look at what we have done and we did to this poor woman and think, wow, she survived that.
You know, I've had people write to me since the book came out about their true fear when they birthed a boy, like some sort of palpable fear, and I just thought it was a great, great adventure. And of course you get what you get and then you never look back, but it's been such a it's sort of like a secret when you only have boys, and you know, to learn to speak it, and then yeah, we could go on and on, right, about boys, but I do love that Jill seems to understand that you gotta have fun with it.
Yeah.
You gotta try to celebrate them.
My mother always said, which I thought was funny, was that she always liked the setup of it with being married to my dad, having five boys, and she said, I think I'm at my best when I'm outnumbered. And I thought, well, that's a good way of looking at it, I guess. Susan Connolly is the author of Landslide. The novel is out from Knopf. In the marriage to Kit, as I alluded to in the introduction, there are tensions, of course, and there is this absence because Kit is away. You write at one point that, I thought of marriage as two people who know each other entirely and will always know each other, but what if they're just two people who share an idea of what life could be, and then one of them changes their idea? Well, man, that just nails it, doesn't it?
Yeah, a couple of folks have pointed that passage out to me, I have to say. Oh, yeah. There's some surprise. We won't give away the ending.
No,
but
we won't.
Yeah.
Well, and I don't want to give away the ending. God knows I don't want to give away the ending, and I won't. But you don't see, you, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I wondered this as I shut the book. But you keep it sort of up in the air, don't you? As to what's
very
going
much.
On?
Yeah,
you
very
don't,
much.
You don't make it definitive as to what happens with this couple.
Nope. Very intentionally. I'm a sucker for an ending that keeps you wondering, you know, keeps sort of you thinking after you've closed the book. And I'm hopeful, frankly. Mm. I'm hopeful for this family. Very hopeful.
Jill seems very reflective throughout the novel. And I love that about her, because she is wondering if she's doing everything right. She's very concerned about what she's doing right. And And I thought of this maybe is because of what probably makes her a really good documentary filmmaker, that she's fascinated with these stories of other people. She knows she's never going to make a fortune in that profession, but it is something that is looking at people and being looking at the past, honoring the past, and trying to get it right for the future that is made her a fascinating character.
Yeah, I'm glad you liked her, or you understood her, I should say. She, you know, there's a lot of opportunity, I think, in her the moment she's in her sort of mid-40s, to wonder if she's getting it right, because she's starting to see that the boys are getting, you know, cooked, as I would say. You know, whatever the heck they've done on that island has made its imprint. And now she's trying to, it's like she's on her last gasp. She's trying to still tell them important things, but they're not listening quite as much. They have their solidarity more between the brothers than with her, which is so natural and important. And she's feeling that. And I do think she is really reflective, for better or for worse. And if you think about the various pressures she's under, you can see why she's really reflective. I mean, she knows that Kit will suffer just greatly if he can't fish again. And it's really unclear if he can. Mm. And if he can, if it will ever support them. So there's a question lurking there too about passions and what we do for money and what we do for passion, and how, I don't know how long she'll even be able to keep making these little sort of historic documentary films she makes, but she's so far been super committed to them.
There is also, and I will close on this, but you certainly explore class in this. There's a point where one of the boys, Sam, is saying, all right, well, I want to go live with somebody else because they have a nicer house. They live over there. And not so much just because of one kid, but because of the whole family. And how crushing that must be for Jill, that her son wants to leave them all and that they've been taken in by this entire family.
Right, yeah. I think he wants to go live in one of the quote-unquote Mick mansions.
Right.
On the mainland. Such a common sort of sentiment I've seen. There's always this sense, or often the sense, it's certain sort of pinnacle moments for teens that they don't have the thing that somebody else has.
Well, the new novel, in the meantime, is Landslide. It is published by Knopf. Susan Connolly, a great pleasure to speak with you. I thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for the beautiful novel.
Oh, it's been my great treat. What a fun conversation. Thanks so much.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.